lot of these people, though, are crying wolf. I think they feel that there's another few years to go before a general election. They don't have to pin their colours to the mast quite yet. And I think as that that wheel starts to turn faster and faster and faster, the flywheel towards the election, I suspect we're going to see more defectors come across from various different parties, not just Conservatives. And also, I think we're going to see some of these specialist individuals as well starting to say the only party in town, the only party worth being part of is Reform. But I think it's still early days. If you think about it, really, Reform has only been truly seen as a contender probably in the last 6 to 8 months. I think since the mayoral elections, people have started to take Reform much more seriously, and the local elections of this year, 2025. In the general election, we were a pain in the backside. We were blamed by the Conservatives for letting Labour in, and had we not stood candidates, we probably still would have a Conservative government. That's their mythological idea, their little unicorn that they like to cling to. But I think that the last 18 months has really shown that there's a huge amount of support there for Reform. Look at the polls. They're, even if you said there's a 5% chance of error on those polls, we're still ahead of all the other parties. So I think it's just going to take another, let's see what happens in another 18 months to see where people are standing there. Give it another Reform conference. Let's have another Labour budget. Let's have the May 2026 local elections. Let's have the Senate elections. Let's have the MSP elections. Then let's see what people are saying about Reform.
Well, you can actually see the process starting already. I mean, if you look at David Starkey, his remarks about Reform 6 to 9 months ago were much more negative. And although he's not fully on board with Reform per se now, he is much, much more open to Reform than he was then. And you can see a similar movement with quite a lot of such commentators.
Yes. Which is why, of course, Danny Kruger has come across.
Yes. And I mean, I did particularly agree with David Starkey that, I mean, he is an outstanding defection from the point of view of Reform, because it sends a direct message to precisely those sorts of influences that Danny Kruger wouldn't have done it if it wasn't serious.
Yes. But I think that just what's very interesting, and we saw this at conference, is that you've got a number of right-wing thinkers, conservatives, small c conservatives, gathering around discussing central issues. Whether they are members of the Conservative Party or members of Reform, what we've got is a coalition of the right. And this is very powerful until it comes to the election, because that's the decision that's going to need to be made, is if we are going to unite the right, which is what Rees-Mogg is suggesting, we've got to understand that at election time, if they stand candidates against Reform, we could divide the right. And so I think that he didn't speak about this, that I didn't hear him speak about this at the conference. He was more talking about the issues that are going to face Reform when they come into government. Again, I think he accepts that Reform will win the next general election. And the issue is more about the constitution and the ceding of control and power to Europe and quangos, frankly, and other bodies which now are part of government, where Parliament no longer has that control. And that was the thrust of the discussion. However, there has to be a discussion as we near a general election about how are these parties then going to operate if they are going to work in some form of concert. Because if they stand against each other, we're demolishing that whole possibility of winning.
I really think that this fear is overblown, and it is one that is peddled by people who are making special pleading for the Conservative Party.
I agree, Nick. I mean, the point is, it's going to be a long time till the next general election. By that time, and the Tories, I think, are 14 points just now. By that time, they'll be in single figures. And they won't really present a threat to us in any seat, I don't think.
I mean, there are probably 20 to 30 seats where it will be, even then, more contention. But apart from those 20 or 30 seats, which might include Tatton and Eddisbury, but very few others. And even them, I think, will be gone. But the point is, what you saw in the last general election was the strength of the squeeze on the third party. I mean, at the peak, we were polling 18, even 19% during the general election campaign. And then in the last 10 days to week, we dropped back down to the sort of 14.5%. And that was the sort of 3-4% that squeeze produced. And that's where the Conservatives were very good at targeting people on the vote reform, get Labour message. But next time round, the boot will be entirely on the other foot. And that squeeze will push the other way. So that extra 3-4%, which the Conservatives took off reform in 2024, will actually swing the other way, because the whole, as long as we're well organised, as long as we concentrate on our party organisation and we do all of our canvassing properly and we get our data right and we approach the voters. I mean, the Conservatives sent out a letter, a personal letter, to everyone that they had recorded as a Conservative likely or a Conservative possible. They certainly did right across Tatton, and to my certain knowledge, they did it in a whole lot of other constituencies as well. And I would think that all the ones where they thought that reform were stealing their thunder in some way during the general election, they will have done that. And that was a very, I've got a copy of the letter somewhere if I look around. That was a very effective squeeze. But I suspect a lot of that would have happened without the letter, because it's just people naturally looking at it and thinking, who is more likely to win? And it'll be playing from the polls. So I think it's Rees-Mogg trying to comfort himself.
Yeah, I mean, anybody in a marginal seat who wants to not have Labour will decide which of the other parties is most likely to win. And in almost all cases, that's going to be us.
Yeah.
I just don't like to count our chickens. I'm more reserved than you are. I am confident, but I still see areas of the country like the Southwest, Scotland, areas of the Southeast, London. Now, these won't necessarily change the actual result of the election. I still think it's going to be a reform majority. I don't think it's going to even be a hung parliament, which one of the suggestions, I think, More in Common poll put us at a hung parliament last week, or just over, just under having a majority and having to form some form of coalition, possibly. I think it's clear we will have a majority if we carry on the train that we're on at the moment. But I do not like to count our chickens, because who knows what could happen between now and 2029. If indeed we have to wait till 2029 for a general election, we've got a budget coming up at the end of November, which could be utter disaster for the country, despite what the automaton called Rachel Reeves says in her interviews, where she's like a little robot. The upcoming budget, it's clear that it's got huge, huge challenges for the Labour government, and it's going to have ramifications across the country. Now, I don't just mean in terms of voting intentions. I also mean in terms of economic impacts. She's understanding that the bond markets will effectively vote on the result of that budget. Within 12 hours, we'll see the impact on those bonds. Now, that is very significant. Andy Burnham, of course, says, we don't want to be in hock to the bond markets anymore. What? You must be mad. The bond markets are where we borrow our money from, darling. Do you not realise? You know, he who pays the piper calls the tune. I'm sorry. Where have you got this idea from that we can't be in hock to the bond markets? This is how our economy works. Utter stupidity, rash comments without any understanding of how the economy functions. But following that budget, I don't think we'll ever have an IMF bailout, as some have been suggesting. Jagdeep Chadha, for example, for the Institute of Economic Affairs has said this. No, I don't think it's Institute of Economic and Social Research has intimated that might be the case. But actually, the IMF do not have the funds to be able to bail us out. Right. So that's an impossibility.
They've just been bailing out Argentina.
Well, there we go. Exactly. So there are, but aside from who and how and why and what, the fact is, if she doesn't get that budget right, it's going to have huge ramifications. And that is aside from all of the current commitments that the government have made to net zero, carbon capture projects, all the other money that seems to be continually just leaching out of the Treasury. The 1.5 billion Jaguar Land Rover loan because of cybersecurity issues last week. Another billion here, another billion there. Wasn't it an American senator, I think, who once said, a billion here and a billion there, and very soon you're talking real money. And that's the state we're in the UK. And it seems that Labour, for all their talking that we're going to be fiscally prudent and responsible, it seems that the message hasn't quite got through to the civil servants, who are quite happy to write these checks for as long as that checkbook has paper in it.
So this is a question I was going to ask Mark Littlewood when I speak to him on Wednesday, to say to him, if you were the Chancellor, if you were Rachel Reeve, what would you do to get some growth into the economy? What measures would you take? So go on, you two can have a go at it.
Well, I mean, I've heard him speak before. He'd be for reducing the administrative burdens on business significantly. And he would be for making significant savings in both the government administrative and benefits budgets. He was asked to come up with a list of 10 places you could save more than £1 billion, and he came up with a list of it. And I think that's really where he would be driving. Reduce government expenditure and remove the barriers to business growth by removing the as much of the red tape jungle as is possible.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. I mean, Nick and I both run small businesses, so we're at the coalface every day. And I liken it to an apple tree that's gone bad. If you have an apple tree, if you've ever grown an apple tree or seen an apple tree, you'll know what I mean, that after a few years of a lack of pruning and a lack of care, sometimes that apple tree isn't producing much fruit anymore. That's where we are in the UK. We are a sick, ill, infested apple tree. And what do you do with an apple tree that's gone bad to produce good fruit again? You do two things. First of all, you prune. You get rid of all the branches, all the excess that is unnecessary, that is taking energy out of that core trunk of the tree that is the conduit through which all the nutrients and sap and so on moves to be able to produce the fruit. But equally, you feed it. Equally, you give it the environment so that the following year, the following summer, those shoots, those buds can produce good quality fruit that can then grow to their full size and be picked and be eaten or put into an apple pie. Delicious. And to me, that's exactly the same analogy that we should be using for the economy. We need to take those two actions. We need to prune, cut back all the excess and really radicalize what we are spending. And we have to also make the people of the UK, the residents of the UK, need to understand that they contribute to that as well. If they are not productive, if they are picking and eating the fruit rather than mulching around the roots of the tree, rather than helping that tree grow, they are adding to the problem. They are making the problem worse. So this has to be about a concerted understanding that we as a nation have to take responsibility for this, and that we have spent far more than we can afford, and we are spending beyond our means each and every hour of each and every day. But the second thing is, absolutely agree with Nick, we have got to enable the engine of growth to restart. And what does that mean? That means reducing regulations. It means cutting legislation. In my business, which is a property business, I would say 60% of my time is spent dealing with government regulation, whether it is right to rent checks, whether it is securing deposits for property checks, whether it is anti-money laundering checks, whether it is some other form of compliance. The amount of time I spend in my working week dealing with all of that government red tape is horrendous. And it is not growing my business. I'm not helping any further tenants get quality properties by doing that, or getting a better letting, or finding a property to buy, or selling a property. There's no transaction that goes on. I'm simply pushing emails, red tape, letters, admin for 60% of my time. It's totally unproductive. And the problem is that because the public sector have become like that, and the public sector have become obese in terms of its size, it's too big for what it needs to be. This culture of over-regulation is now being applied into the private sector as well. We are required to maintain, sustain the same levels of administrative burden as does the public sector. Now, that's totally wrong. The private sector needs to be free to operate in its own way in a free market economy. And I would be absolutely advocating that we must reduce the size of the public sector as well. So it has to be both. It has to be not exactly carrot and stick, but it has to be pruning and it has to be feeding. And that way the tree can grow, and it will take time. It's not going to be overnight, but give it a few weeks, a few months, and I think you would soon start to see the impact of that kind of radical transformation.
I think
it's not an element. So not an element, though, whereby if you look at what Rachel Reeve is actually going to do in November, now why it's November, I've no idea, because it's, you know, it should have been now really that she's having it. But in November, if she were to try to increase taxation again, what she would find is that while she could increase the rates of taxation, the tax take would actually reduce, because of the Laffer curve and the fact that people, you can only go to the well so often. And if she raised it, then people would actually pay less tax. Now, is there not then an argument that the solution to get growth, to kickstart the economy, is to reduce the taxes? So you reduce all of the taxes. You reduce income tax, you reduce corporation tax, et cetera, et cetera. And that would be the thing that, in my view, would kickstart the economy. Now, people will say, well, you can't do that because we haven't got the fiscal room to do that. But in actual fact, if I'm right, then you'll actually find that the tax take will go up.
The problem you have, Ken, it's the Liz Truss problem.
Yeah.
If you front end that, you will run into very severe headwinds. One thing I completely agree with, a little aside that Wendy made, is that the lag on the effect of deregulation is quite significant. And because the extent of the bonfire of the red tape will in itself be destabilizing, because people get used to a certain structure, people will tend to wait to make their decisions until things have settled down to see if it's all going to turn to a pile of dust. And so you can do that. But there is a place that you can actually deliver much more immediate effect. If you look at the OBR calculations on growth, which drove stupidly the decisions on this migration, you have to have migration in order to achieve growth, because you've got to put more labour input into the economy to achieve that growth. Now, that's true to a certain extent, except that we brought in the wrong sort of labour and we discounted all of the consequential costs of that. But there is a very significant source of quite effective labour that's already in the country. And so if you do take a severe axe to government and you release 250,000 to 300,000 public servants into the economy, those are people who are well qualified and will find themselves jobs in the private sector. They might not like the process, but the vast majority of them will end up productively employed. And given the size of our workforce, an additional 250,000 people suddenly arriving in the workforce will be a major fillip to growth. And instead of being a dead weight on the economy, they will be helping the economy forward. And in fact, you then get a multiplier effect because a lot of private sector employers are employing a significant chunk of their workforce in order to deal with the regulations which those people you've just let go from the public sector were essentially imposing on them. And so the private sector employers can then redeploy. So, for example, if you make major reductions in the employment regulatory regime, then HR departments can see consequential reductions in their manpower requirement. And those people who are being freed up from HR departments because they no longer have to cope with the scale of regulation can be redeployed onto more productive areas within the same businesses or in a different business. And the same thing goes across a whole range of regulation. And that, I think, would be a more direct effect of slashing the size of the government. And then I think the second order is where you then look more aggressively at the tax base, because when businesses have had a chance to reassess the position and they see that the whole pack of cards hasn't fallen in, and at the same time you reduce tax rates, and you can reduce tax rates in a way that tries to bring it forward. So, for example, if you give a temporary reduction in tax, you may be intending to make it permanent, but you don't say it's a permanent reduction. What you do is you say we're going to put a 18-month to two-year reduction in the tax rate. That will bring forward investment and activity because people want to carry out that activity in the period when the tax is lower. If then you find that that has actually resulted in an increased tax because of increased activity, well, then you can extend the period where you have reduced the tax. So you can be clever in the way that you use the tax system. But you can't really go aggressively on the tax side until you've made the savings in the public expenditure, so that in terms of the government financial position, you're not creating a roadblock at the beginning. So it's sequencing that is crucial. And what you were saying, Ken, is very much what Liz Truss was saying. And I have a lot of sympathy for that in abstract. So the problem with Liz Truss wasn't what she was saying was needed to make the economy go. It was how she delivered it and the sequencing of the changes.
Well, you can say that. I have a slightly different view on it. I think that she was effectively taken down by the blob, in particular by the Bank of England, who took deliberate action to bring her down. And I think it's, if you look at what happened with the what they did in terms of the working with the they deliberately made the bond yields go out.
Well, that's true, but it actually makes the point. I mean, she was foolish in the way she pushed forward, not taking into account the response that she would get. And the Bank of England behaved reprehensibly, there's no doubt about it, as did other elements of the government and indeed the international community and the press and large parts of the Conservative Party, let us not forget, were out to get her. But if you know everyone's out to get you, you don't act in a way that walks straight into their trap. And that was the sheer stupidity of Liz Truss, is she disregarded what she was going to run into, because it didn't take the brains of an archbishop to see that the blob, as you described them, was going to respond in that way. And if that's the case, you have to cut your coat according to your cloth. And
well, I think she lost her nerve. I think that's what happened. I mean, you look, the bond yields now are higher than they were when she spooked them.
Yes, and where do we get that being reported? Very rarely, do we? You're absolutely right, Ken. Bond yields are higher now than they were then.
Yeah, but you have to accept, not signed the Chancellor. They could have seen it out, I think.
Yeah, I know they couldn't have done, because, and this is the problem with migration as well, and many other areas. The reason she could not have sat it out was that the Parliamentary Conservative Party would not have allowed her to sit it out. She had a majority from the Conservative Party members, which is why they made damn sure that there wasn't a repeat of allowing the Conservative Party members to elect her successor. But she was only ever supported by a minority of the Parliamentary Party. But the point is, she knew that. She knew where the bulk of the Parliamentary Party was coming from. And if you're ignoring something, as you're walking into their trap and you're just ignoring it, you're going to end up in the trap.
One of the problems I feel about Liz Truss is that she diagnosed the problem absolutely accurately, but her prescription was wrong. It was the wrong time. And she rushed to give that prescription. And as you say, Nick, it was a double-sided sword, a double-sided coin, because on one side she was giving subsidies away, energy subsidies, to because we'd had such a turbulent time with energy and energy costs, and yet on the other side she was giving tax breaks. And I think this mixed message, although she believed that this was going to generate growth and it was going to enable us to be able to afford the subsidies longer term, unfortunately, it didn't, because she hadn't consulted widely enough, and we may disagree with the need to be able to consult thus widely, because ultimately she was Prime Minister, and therefore, and with her Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng, it should have been sufficient for her, along with the Cabinet, to be able to agree, this is the course of action, this is what we're going to do. But that wasn't the environment they were working in. And I think there has to be an acknowledgement. And we see this with reform even now in their preparation for government. There's an acknowledgement that the machinations of government, the apparatchiks who work on the outskirts, who are perhaps the invisible men who are influencing how economic news is delivered, how budgets are rolled out, these people have to be currently part and parcel of that process. Ignore them at your peril. And I feel that's where Liz Truss went wrong. Of course, she was thrown under the bus by the Bank of England and actually by the bond markets, and because of the challenges with pensions, because of her budget. Many of us would have cheered at the budget. Go for it, Liz. This is great. It's bold. It's definitive. It's certain. We're clear what you're trying to achieve. We love it. But unfortunately, those of us who might say, yeah, this was great, there were many, many others who obviously did not like it at all and reacted against it. And to me, this was simply her running at the gate too early. And had she been able to hold her nerve a little bit longer, I think we may have seen a slightly different length of tenure for Liz Truss. And I was very sad when she was ousted.
Well, the underlying reason was she only had, at best, a third of the parliamentary party behind her.
And do you think, Nick, that the parliamentary party, the Lib Dems and the Tories, do you think they would actually have brought her down?
I mean, the thing is, the present Prime Minister is a very different position because of the rules. Although, having said that, he has just made it, stupidly, you might say, easier for a challenge, because the Labour Party rules used to only allow a challenge during the party conference, but they've now allowed the group of MPs, but there have to be 80 of them to force a challenge. But that is at least mildly easier than it was before. But in the case of Liz Truss, those letters would have gone in to the 1922 committee and she'd have been in toast, because she could not have won a vote. And in fact, as soon as the chairman of the 1922 committee had the 40 or so letters, I forget the precise number, but it was nothing like as much as 80, from MPs who wanted a vote, he'd have called the vote. They'd have had it within a week, and she would not have won the vote amongst the parliamentary party. She'd have had to have stepped down. So she left before she was pushed. And it's that travesty of the lack of representation in Parliament of the Conservative Party members, who I think would overwhelmingly have supported her, that caused that problem. And and there was nowhere else to put. I mean, a reform prime minister would be in a better position, because the parliamentary party would be more solidly behind them, so it's easier to ride things out. But nevertheless, and I mean, we're having this in the context of tax and expenditure, but the same conversation could be had over changing the migration rules. And that is that in both cases, we first have to restore control of the government by the government and to remove the levers of power from the likes of the Bank of England and the OBR and 101, well, about 400, I believe, quangos. And until you have restored parliamentary control over all of those things, rushing forward with anything that isn't clearly in your manifesto is going to get you into trouble. And we couldn't have all of that stuff set out in our manifesto for all sorts of practical reasons. But I mean, there are a few tax cuts we could bring in straight away. So, for example, the raising the tax threshold to £20,000, which most of the Conservative Party say how financially irresponsible that is and so on and so forth. What they don't mention is it's only because Cameron and Osborne and then subsequent Conservative Prime Ministers and the current lot froze the thresholds and that all we're doing is restoring that to the level which it was at before Cameron came to power. So it's not like it's completely out of kilter with that new level. It's
well, the other element of that, Nick, I think it's a great idea, but I know people like to throw sticks and stones at it, believing it's unaffordable. But there are millions of people who are on lower incomes and being taxed, and yet we are also subsidising them with universal credit. So we have this ridiculous situation where people are earning maybe £18,000-£19,000, are subject to income tax, and yet they're also being subsidised by the government through universal credit. Not only is this a ridiculous system, it also goes back to your point about freeing up some of those jobs in the public sector, which basically are just running the admin. They're just jobs that are actually running the regulations. They're not actually doing anything else. And if we could remove those people from being dependent on universal credit because we've been able to give them more money in their pocket because they're not being taxed on it, immediately this starts to release people from the poverty trap. Because when you are dependent on benefits and yet you're also a working person, and I think there's 1.1 million people who fall into that typology, if you might say, those people are in a benefits trap because they cannot earn. They perhaps might try to earn more money in order to get out of it, but as soon as they earn whatever the levels are, suddenly their universal credit is cut altogether. So all those extra benefits they get from being on universal credit no longer apply. So they keep themselves below that level. And I actually think it also applies to VAT thresholds. I would like to see the VAT threshold go up. And I've actually done a piece of work on this and I've crunched the numbers. And if we were to raise the VAT threshold for small businesses to £120,000, and I know there's arguments either way. One way would be to make VAT mandatory for all small businesses. And that's another argument that you can discuss. But the fact is, at the moment, the VAT threshold sits at £90,000. We know there are many sole traders who keep their turnover under £90,000, so they do not have to register for VAT. And so when it comes to, you know, January, February, coming up to the end of the financial year, they say to themselves, well, I won't do so much work because
on that time of year.
Sorry, Ken?
You can't get a plumber in January or February.
Exactly. And this is the reason why.
You can if you pay cash. The other thing I would say is this is very dependent on sector because the impact of the VAT threshold depends on how much of the input is labour value added and how much of it is materials and so on. So a VAT threshold for a retail establishment has a very different impact than the VAT threshold for a plumber, for example.
But you still have the administrative burden. And I think even for a business that relies on taxable, VAT-able supplies, where it can perhaps get some benefit because its VAT returns will enable an income benefit rather than a VAT return that means that they're paying more money to the Treasury. It's still the level of time and effort they have to put into putting in that VAT return. And crunching the numbers, if we were to raise the VAT threshold to £120,000, this would be a sweet spot whereby corporation tax take would go up and would almost, not entirely, but it would almost make up for the fact that you are now losing VAT from those companies that were perhaps turning over between £90,000 and £120,000. So that £30,000 gap, where you'd be losing some tax take because those are no longer VAT rated businesses. £120,000 is the sweet spot. And this would encourage businesses to grow. And going back to the discussion about how do we encourage growth in the economy, I think this would be a key way. 98% of businesses in the UK are counted as small or micro businesses. 98%. So when we talk about business, I think a lot of people think about Amazon or, big companies, car manufacturing companies, or, I mean, local to us, you know, Bentley Motor Cars, AO, Tesco, you know, some of these big retail consortiums and so on. Well, okay, but they only make up 2% of businesses in Great Britain. Therefore, 98% of those businesses are affected by this. And if we want growth to happen, again, it goes back to the apple tree analogy. It's better that we have lots and lots of little apple trees producing tens of pounds of apples than rely on 20 massive orchards, each apple tree having to produce 200 pounds of apples. Far better that we spread this across the whole of the United Kingdom. Better for the businesses, better for the consumer, better for the nation.
And it isn't quite as simple as that. I do speak with some authority on the subject, having spent a lot of my career on precisely this front. I mean, what you have to remember is of those 98%, there's probably less than 20% of them that are employing a significant number of people. And any people at all, two-thirds of them are just a sole trader. And those sole traders, there is a very sort of steep curve. A few sole traders make significant amounts of money, but very few sole traders get close to the VAT registration threshold in aggregate numbers. If you want to look at, I mean, and in fact, if you exclude those that are employers, so the non-employer ones, that it's significantly less than 10% of gross value added by GDP that they create. So although they're large in numbers, they're very small in terms of economic impact. Once you start looking at the people who are employers, small and medium-sized employers, as opposed to small and medium-sized businesses, do employ two-thirds of the workforce. But actually, although they employ two-thirds of the workforce, they account for less than 40% of gross value added. So the top 1% or 2% are accounting for well more than 60% of the gross value added in the economy. So while I like the sentiment that you're making, you just have to be slightly cautious as to how these things impact on the economy as a whole.
I think the dangers of digital ID are obvious to everybody. And it's actually not digital ID itself that's the problem. It's the fact of we don't know what the government are going to do with it, and nobody trusts the government to not do the bad things with it, which is the problem. But it's a lot of people are very motivated by it. I don't know what the Conservative Party's stance on it is.
I haven't particularly heard about that. What worries me about digital ID is a number of things. First of all, I think it is ideology wrapped up as pragmatism, and that always bothers me, that we're shielded from the real reasons. Mm. We're being told that this is part of the government's attempt to stop illegal immigrants from getting jobs in the UK. and that by having digital ID, we'll clearly see who they are and we can say, no, you can't work and you can't have a job. Well, we can do that already. So that argument doesn't stack up. Right. Then the second thing is it'll make all your records integrated and, you know, allow us to be able to see if, you know, we owe you some tax, for example. When does that ever happen? Mostly if I ever have tax due to me from the HMRC, it takes quite a long time to get it refunded. And usually it's them wanting tax from me. And of course, if I owe them tax, I've got to pay it within a certain deadline or I start to have to pay interest on that money. I've never known them to pay interest to me if they over owe me tax. But I think that so from a pragmatic systems point of view, for example, if it was a private company that offered a number of different services to its customers or its clients, you might say it makes sense for us to have an all-encompassing digital ID that allows you to access your dentistry, your healthcare, your prescriptions, etc. Let's imagine that's a private healthcare company. You can understand the pragmatics behind it, but let's think about some of the practicalities here as well. I was a non-executive director for Cheshire and Wirral Partnership NHS Trust about 20 years ago. And it was during that time that the Labour government wanted to implement the national programme for IT. And this was touted as being a magnificent IT programme that was going to integrate people's notes, their care notes, their records, and it would allow any medic across the UK to be able to access your health records at the flick of a switch, at the touch of a button. Oh, how exciting it was going to be. But within about 3 months of initiating the project, the government recognised that this was absolutely unachievable. It was such a huge task to digitise all of these records at a time when the government was already lagging behind digitalization in many, many services. The rest of us were already on email and, you know, utilizing the internet every day, but, you know, the government was lagging behind anyway, as it normally does. And they reckoned that it would speed things up, it would make things more efficient. But of course, the program itself was going to be horrendously expensive. And as usual, as we've seen with HS2 and many other government programs, the initial cost, the initial budget that was set down was not the real budget, because once you then recognize the challenges of integrating all these different IT systems, all the different the different processes, the different programs, the different environments that these systems had to be based on, it was absolutely impossible to create this national program for IT. So I actually just don't think it's doable at a cost that is going to be cost effective. And I just don't think that really any government probably since the Second World War could prove that it has a very good history and being able to deliver these programs efficiently to date, on date, to target and in budget. It just doesn't happen. So I think it's a pie in the sky that it's going to even happen, frankly, because I just don't think they will be able to do it. So I think we've got this pragmatic argument that is hiding the ideology behind it, which is to more state control. Mm. I think we have the cost of it, which we haven't seen any, at least I haven't seen any budgetary costings put forward for this particular program yet at all. And thirdly, we have the actual reality of whether the government can actually deliver this, which I very, very, very much doubt. Certainly not by 2030.
We saw during COVID when they were trying to get the NHS app going, or the vaccination app going, and they weren't even able to do that. They spent millions and billions of pounds and messed the whole thing up. It never worked. And instead of using going on the Apple platform or the Google platform or whatever and building it from there, which would have worked, they decided, oh, no, we're going to do our own. We're all going to start our own from scratch. It's just absolute nonsense, and they always make this mistake in IT. I mean, government and IT just don't work. I mean, the NHS are still using fax machines, believe it or not. It's just unbelievable. So yes, you're right. I think practically it would be very difficult, certainly to do it within a reasonable timescale, say the life of this government. I can't see it happening. But I think that for me, the bigger issue is not so much the practicality, but it's the what happened during COVID. Because what that showed was the ability of the government and the instinct of the government to take control, to try to actually influence what people do in their lives. I mean, I remember I just got towards the end of COVID, I managed to get booked a holiday to Turkey. And up until then, you hadn't been able to go anywhere virtually because, you know, I had no vaccination. And so therefore, there was nowhere I could go almost. But Turkey, you could go, providing you had a test before and a test there and so on. So I did all that, had the test. But then when I came back, I was supposed to isolate for, I think it was a week when I came back. So one day, the following week, I got a knock on the door. And I went to the door and said, this chap saying there, just checking that you're self-isolating. And this was the extent of the coercion that was going on. And yes. I said, well, look, you can see I'm here. And he said, but I don't know who you are. You need to prove your identity. And I thought about it afterwards, and I should have just closed the door on him. But, you know, at the time, because of the way the COVID scare was manipulated and the people were not as bold as they would normally be, I think.
Well, I think it's really interesting because I was listening to a fascinating monologue by Jacob Rees-Mogg the other day on his YouTube channel. And in that, he was describing the basis upon which we have freedoms in the UK as opposed to Europe, where Europe's culture is based on, if you like, the state has control and you are given your freedom by the state. Whereas in the UK, there is a fundamental belief and almost constitutional underpinning that freedom is a given and state control is an additional layer that will be brought in, for example, if you break the law. If you do certain things, that's when you will have the force of the state. And I suppose it goes back to that legal concept of habeas corpus. You know, you are you're innocent until proven guilty. You're not guilty until your defense barrister proves you innocent. It's the way, if you like, it's the procedural belief, the underpinning understanding that we are free. And that our freedoms can only be constrained if we do something to constrain it. And an ID card goes absolutely, flies right in the face of that basic understanding, that basic constitutional and democratic belief. And of course, this is to a certain degree, we go all the way back to Magna Carta. No taxation without representation. This whole idea, which is that people's freedoms matter. And if you're going to take money away from us, you must represent our best endeavors in government. And the problem with ID, of course, is it removes it. You are putting your private information in the hands of the state. So the state automatically has information about you before you are able to even say, I don't want you to have that information. That's private.
Mm. And the other thing about it is that I mean, I used to travel to China. And if you've ever been to China, you know how it works. And they are much more advanced technologically than we are. Everything operates on QR codes and so on. And so therefore they find it very easy to control the population with technology. So in other words, if you go along and you want to get a train to Guangzhou or wherever, and if you go and try and buy your ticket, if the state doesn't like you for some reason or you've done something wrong or whatever, you just aren't allowed to buy it. And they have this. And now I'm not saying, you know, you say, well, that's China, that's different. It's not like the UK. They wouldn't do that to us. I don't believe it. I think they absolutely would do it to us because I think that these people who want to have power over people, they will use it.
Yes. And the other thing that worries me about the ID card, and I know you might say, but Wendy, that's just, you know, that's just a sort of practicality. It's nothing to be worried about. It's a risk and we can overcome the risk. And I do accept that some of these risks may be greater than others. But look what happened last week with Jaguar Land Rover. It had to have a government loan to bail it out because it faced a cyber attack. And it shut down its production. The supply chains have also been affected. Many, many smaller businesses that supply to JLR have also had to halt production or certainly reduce their manufacturing because of what's happened at JLR. Now, it turns out what happened at JLR was that it was in the process of renewing its insurance that would have protected against cyber attacks. It didn't renew that insurance in time. A cyber attack occurred. And as a result of that, the government had to step in and effectively bail it out. Now, why am I bringing this up? Well, because number one, it shows that our own national infrastructure and defences, which nowadays can't just be weapons and soldiers in boots on the ground. We have to recognise that cyberspace, cybersecurity is as big, if not a bigger threat to the UK than hot war. But the fact is, if we're going to protect ourselves against cybersecurity and cyber attacks, this will attack potentially could attack any IT system, whether it's Jaguar Land Rover capacity to buy brake fluid for its cars, or the national program for identity cards. It's actually not going to be a card; it's an online identity. Who's to say that we are going to be protected against our individual data being hacked and being stolen by some third party? And yep. We've seen this happen before with HMRC. We've seen it happen with DWP, where there have been some huge data breaches and people's personally identifiable information has been stolen. Well, this is a huge risk. And therefore, you do not want to have all your information on health, income, investments, pension arrangements and so on in one place, because if those are hacked and stolen, who's to say whether you'll ever get them back again?
Yeah, I agree. But the other thing, as I say, is that we nobody trusts governments anymore. Nobody trusts the state, because again, if you look at, you know, you look at what happened in Canada when they had these truckers and so on, they stopped their bank accounts. You know, they closed Nigel's bank account because they didn't like his politics. So we're not far away from that. So you imagine you give Keir Starmer the power to stop people's money if he doesn't like them. It's fairly terrifying, isn't it?
It absolutely is, Ken. And I think that, of course, many commentators have said this is a precursor to introducing digital currency solely and effectively eliminating cash from our currency system. And while, again, I think that is probably inevitable, I think we are certainly on route to having purely digital currency. And I'm not talking crypto here. I'm just talking about online. And the cash economy probably will be eliminated. Yeah. Nevertheless, I feel that that is not a decision that the government has a right to take on its own. And this is part of the challenge, is that what we're doing is we're saying that we're giving the power to the state to make decisions about how we transact with one another. And I always take issue with that. If I want to buy a bag of tomatoes from my next door neighbour from their allotment and give them £10 in cash, I should be allowed to do that. I should be able to do that. Not allowed, but able to do that. If I want to give a tip to, you know, the window cleaner for a good job that he's done and give him, you know, a fiver in cash, I should be able to do that. And now what he does with that fiver is entirely up to him, whether he declares it or he doesn't declare it. Again, that's really not my business. Of course, if he should be declaring it as income. But there are many people in the UK who still rely on cash as a system of exchange. And I don't think it should be up to the government to decide solely, again, through the back door, that it's going to do away with cash. I think that is a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, I agree. Good. Okay.
So we're very much in agreement that it's not a good idea.
But as I say, I don't know. I don't. I haven't divined what the Tory party's stance on it is. I haven't heard them say anything about it. They seem to just be keeping their heads down.
Well, I think in time they will no doubt comment. Usually they're a little bit again behind the curve, and they will come out with some kind of comment. And I would also imagine that Zia and Nigel will come out with a comment on digital ID.
They have come out. They have definitely come out and said that they're against it.
They've said they're against it.
I saw some stats earlier that of reform supporters, 75% of reform supporters are against digital ID, which contrasts with Labour and Conservative, where it was about half and half, 50-50. So
yeah, that's interesting. Again, I think because reform supporters have as one of their fundamental values freedom. They believe in freedom. They don't believe in state control. They don't believe in central planning. They don't believe in taxation and regulation. They believe in having a state that is there for the benefit of the residents, the benefit of the inhabitants of the UK. The inhabitants of the UK are not there for the benefit of the state. And that's the problem with digital ID, is it turns volte-face the relationship between the state and the individual. And therefore, it is a very, very dangerous path to go down. But as I say, I don't think it's ever going to be achievable anyway. I don't think we've got the ability to do it. As you have mentioned as well, Ken, the actual the skills, the actual infrastructure to be able to deliver, I think we probably don't have the specialists to be able to enable this to happen. And I simply don't think that we can afford it. We're in massive debt at the moment. The economy is going down the pan. We haven't seen growth. We've got inflation continuing to grow. And okay, interest rates have come down a little bit this year, but nevertheless, we know that the country is stagnant. How on earth can we now suddenly afford probably a multi-billion pound IT project?
Yeah.
No.
You're right. I mean, we said that it's almost impossible to see that they could do it within the lifetime of this parliament, but that doesn't mean that they can't find ways of spending a huge amount of money not doing it, which is what will happen. It'll end up in Tony Blair's son's pocket. So it's not good.
Correct. It could end up like another bat tunnel on the route, the HS2 route from London to Birmingham. And we all know how that ended.